This is China Business Cast, your guide to doing business in the wild, wild east. We're here to get detailed and get personal with experienced entrepreneurs making things happen in China. If you want to learn from on-the-ground accounts of how business actually gets done, this is the program for you. Hello and welcome to China Business Cast. I'm your host, JP. As you may have noticed, it's been a while since the previous episode. Recently, I've been quite occupied with my own business project, so I haven't been able to stick to a regular publishing schedule. So apologies for that. If you'd like to hear episodes more frequently, here's how you can help. If you know someone who'd be a good guest for China Business Cast, please send me an email, jp@chinabusinesscast.com, and I'll try my best to get them on the show. All right, on to today's show. Today, we've got a great guest on the show. Those of you who are fans of China-themed podcasts may already be familiar with his work over at China History Podcast. So without further ado, here's today's show. Today's guest is Laszlo Montgomery, the host and humble narrator of the Must Listen China History Podcast. If you haven't listened to the podcast before, I highly recommend checking it out. It's truly an excellent listen for anyone with even a passing interest in Chinese history. Aside from having an interest in Chinese history, Laszlo also has a breadth of experience in the Chinese manufacturing industry, having worked in the field for over two decades. Today, we're here to discuss the history of the manufacturing industry in China, where it is now, and what the future holds. Welcome to the show, Laszlo.
Thank you. Thank you, JP. Pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. So for today, I have three very specific goals. Being, you know, a man of who's fond of history, we love to get an understanding of the early days of the Chinese manufacturing industry. So a little bit of history there. And then number two, understand the progress of the manufacturing industry in China over the years and how it's grown and developed. And then finally, let's have a discussion around where the industry is now and challenges and opportunities facing the industry in the future. Okay, so with that in mind, and before jumping straight into the details, can you give us a little bit of a background around your China story? So when did you first make contact with China, and what led you to what you're doing today?
You know, I had an early fascination with Asia in general my whole life from a kid. And I was in college from 77 to 81, University of Illinois. And I started studying Japanese history first. I was into Japan. But this led me to China. You know, a lot of the things I was learning in Japanese history came from China. So I started studying about China, Chinese history, and then I started studying Mandarin in the summer of 1979. This was a few months after Deng Xiaoping visited the States, and everyone said, you know, the future, U.S. and China. But I went to Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China in 1980, and I was just hooked. And I knew that this was the world for me, and I was determined to find some place in it. You know, my 20s were a blur. I spent trying to get some kind of China career going. But in September 89, I moved out to Hong Kong to look for a job. Just went out cold, bought a one-way ticket, and I started in this industry. October 89, right after I got out there, been doing it ever since. From 89 to 1998, I was in Hong Kong. And, you know, over 25 years, I've been working for Chinese companies. I've always earned my paycheck from the Chinese, you know, working in sales, marketing, product development, project management, these kind of roles. And then, you know, because of who I am, I'm also a personal advisor to these companies, a fixer, a concierge, a Western expert, do all kinds of PR for them. So basically, in a nutshell, being the eyes and ears of a Chinese firm in the U.S. and, you know, handling any and all kinds of problems or needs that they might have, business or personal. So it's sort of a niche career.
Certainly. And what first led you to manufacturing? Was it just that it was such a booming industry at the time, or was it a personal interest?
No personal interest whatsoever. It was just fate. Yeah, I moved out to Hong Kong to look for a job, any kind of China job. You know, this is right only a few months after June 4th, so things were really not good. My timing was terrible, but yeah, I had a friend in the sourcing business. He did product development for a firm up in Van Nuys. He ran their Hong Kong office. So when I moved out, he introduced me to one of his cut and sew vendors, and they ended up hiring me. So I moved out in September. I started working in October. This first job, it was just the ultimate university to learn the trade. This outfit was a huge cut and sew manufacturer. They made bags, luggage, tents, golf bags, sleeping bags, you name it, anything with a sewing machine. Didn't do garments. Now, on top of all the manufacturing that we did, they did a ton of trading as well. So I learned how to work with Kmart, Walmart, importers, Li and Fung, traders, all these old-fashioned agents. So I did sourcing all over China, you know, in addition to having to go to the factory, you know, 3-4 times a week. I was also sourcing all over China, and I load up a suitcase with samples and just went all over the place looking for makers. In those days, this was the early 90s, I worked with a lot of the IECs, you know, the state-owned import-export corporations. They were still around. And, you know, we walked Canton Fair all the time, and I learned how to wine and dine, you know, all these officials and, you know, heads of these companies. And it was very interesting. I was the only white guy in the room wherever I went. And I was a fly on the wall inside this Chinese company, observing all the Chinese office politics, which pretty much the same as what we have in the States. And I was privy to all the staff gossip and goings on. It was just a fantastic education. It was like this day in, day out for 9 years. I worked 5.5 years in Tokwa Wan, and 2 years in Taipo, and about a year and a half in TST, Chim Sa Choi. And these, so the offices of these companies were in Hong Kong, and then the factories were all in Shenzhen, Bao'an. So I passed through Luowu and Fuyong, you know, 1,000 times. You know, any sourcing guy who lived in Hong Kong and made that Shenzhen run all the time knows that drill very well.
Okay, so that's how you first got started in the manufacturing industry, was through this introduction in a cut and sew company. And how has that led you to what you're doing today? You're still in the manufacturing industry, but
yeah,
with
still
a different company, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I worked for one bag guy, then I worked for a paper guy. And this firm I'm with right now, they're based in Ningbo, and they're also in paper products, you know, among other businesses, but that's their core business, is paper converting, you know, stationery, office supplies, packaging, anything that's made out of paper, printed. So after, in all three companies I worked for, all were public companies. Two were public on the Hong Kong exchange, and the guys I'm with now, they're on the Shenzhen exchange. So I've been with them since 2001. So we're going on 13 years together. They're based in Ningbo. You know, they're just making that that paper, that printed mass market baihuo, you know, stuff you see in the stores for, you know, $1 to $5, or maybe 1 to 5 euros. So this is the third China manufacturer that I have hooked up with since 89. And because I had a paper background with a previous company, I had a lot of, you know, I at least had a few million dollars business that I was able to bring to these guys, you know, right away and get them going in the States. And, you know, now they're doing about 60 million, 70 million in the States. So I take care of these guys from an LA base. You know, the other two, I'd lived in Hong Kong. But this works fine. I'm here. They're a good manufacturer. They got everything they need for success. But my people, you know, the guys I work for and many other China manufacturers like them, and a lot of them are intimidated about the U.S. and just totally confounds them. And most of the time, their language skills aren't really there. So the guys I work with, they prefer to deal, you know, with the American companies through me a lot of the time. So I know what they're trying to say. I know what their objective is. So I just serve as their advocate and try to, you know, move the discussion to a point where they feel ready to, you know, deal with the issue directly. And, you know, usually the American side, they prefer to deal with me. It's just a lot easier for them. So from 2001 till now, I've just helped these guys grow their sales, get into new categories, get in the middle of new, you know, I get in the middle of all their product development issues, I manage their customers, and yeah, do my best to defend them or, you know, lessen their pain following any kind of manufacturing screw up. So I like the kind of work that I do, you know, just helping these Chinese companies out. I don't really care for the industry so much, you know, selling baihuo, all this general merchandise to the U.S. mass market. 25 years of that, I think, is enough. But I found, you know, my skill set, which is taking care of Chinese companies and all the ways that I do, it could really be applied to almost any industry. So now I'm newly free, and I just started talking with other firms in China, well, I'm still, you know, helping these guys out, in the guys in Ningbo. There are so many Chinese companies and entrepreneurs, and they know what they want here in the States, but they just need someone to hold their hand and look out for them and, you know, guide them. So either they don't speak English or they don't understand the lay of the land here in the States, or both. So with me, they can move about freely, conveniently, and effectively. And you know, I speak Chinese, so I could deal with them in their own language. They like that. Knowing that they got someone standing by in LA to take care of whatever they need 24/7, it's priceless to some people in China. So not everyone needs this kind of service, but some in China do. So this is what I'm doing today outside of the China History Podcast.
Fantastic. Yeah, having been at it for 25 years in the manufacturing industry, that's got to be a boatload of experience, and I'm very excited to dig into that today. So with that brief background in mind, let's dig into the details then. It's always good to start at the beginning, so let's go back to the early days, as early as we can go. Can you tell us a bit about those early days of manufacturing in China?
When I first went to work in Hong Kong, and I moved out there in 89, I showed up at the Merit Industrial Center in To Kwa Wan. That was a fax machine world. There was no internet yet. And it was, in fact, it was just the final vapors of telex machines. You still had cable addresses on some business cards. You know, some places in China in the 90s, they still communicated via cable. And then typewriters on every desk still. Nobody had PCs. I had to drag my company kicking and screaming to get a desktop PC with a 40 megabyte hard drive back in like 92 or 93. But the business then, OEM manufacturing, there was a real sense of partnership. You know, the business was more relationship-driven, more face-to-face with customers, there was more sincerity. Anything was possible, I mean, no matter how difficult. And retailers were much more forgiving and a lot easier to work with. It really was a fantastic business, a great industry, you know, the world of making things in China and exporting to the United States. Yeah, the Canton Sphere was still in the old place, you know, across the street from the Dongfang Hotel, the China Hotel. I used to do sourcing trips in China, you know, in the 90s. That was always an adventure. You know, China hadn't hit the big time yet. These IEC people that we dealt with, the import-export corporations, they were just such a pleasure to work with. You know, they were not slick at all. You know, as long as you gave them enough guidance, kept an eye on them, but they were nice and dependable. And the prices you got out of these guys back in the 90s were just fantastic. So we farmed so much business out to these guys, you know, mostly in Hunan and Fujian. You could be a middleman, you know, back in those days. You could still make a killing. An OEM factory, back then, you could make 30, 40% gross margin selling all this general merchandise to U.S. retail. And if you also did trading, there were some real deals to be had if you had the fortitude to go to all these regional China shows and keep your eyes peeled, you know, and live in all those dumpy hotels. I mean, you had to get on a bus, a train, or an airplane to go see all these factories. There was no other way to tell. You know, the technology wasn't there yet. You couldn't do these virtual tours of these factories. The internet changed everything. I mean, for me, it just took all the fun out, just made the business very mechanical and impersonal. In the 80s and 90s, it was importers who ran the show and dominated business with all these OEM factories, you know, like the guys I worked for. Now, the U.S. retailers, whenever they can, they go around the American importer and they just take the business direct to the factories. You know, and the product managers that work for these retailers, I mean, they don't know much compared to what the importers did. You know, the importers, they more specialized in their category.
Okay, so those were the early days. And I guess it was the arrival of the internet, among other things, that really changed things. Talking to people, you know, there was a period of really high growth in terms of everyone just getting into the business and everyone making great profits in China sourcing and manufacturing. What were those times like?
Oh, the 90s. I mean, they were explosive. All the reforms Deng Xiaoping started in 1979, you know, by the 90s had matured, you know, to a point where the system began to catch fire. And this is especially right after Deng made his southern tour in 1992. I mean, the place just went wild from about 92, 93 till about 2005, maybe 2006. there was just fabulous growth in export manufacturing, you know, but I think that was like the final hurrah. Manufacturing and export are still strong. I mean, it's as strong as it ever was, but I don't think there's an attractive bottom line for these guys that describe these OEM manufacturers. That's when the shift happened, when the import-export corporations faded out and the private entrepreneurs took over manufacturing. These guys were way more aggressive and their numbers grew quickly, you know, which naturally drove prices down further. So, you know, made in China in the 90s, early 2000, it was booming all over the world. They just couldn't open factories fast enough. Those were great years, like, you know, like I described, the 80s and 90s were the golden age for these OEM China factories.
Great. And, well, the picture has shifted somewhat, right? Nowadays, at least from talking to friends who are in the manufacturing business, a lot of them are complaining about all the things that are stacked against them. Rising exchange rate, higher cost of labor. In fact, quite a few friends, I think they've looked at shifting their business model and getting out of the sourcing business. When do you think the scales started to tip?
Yeah, it was definitely by the 21st century, 2000, thereabouts. I noticed, you know, first of all, the internet came along and in no time at all commoditized all of these OEM manufacturers who made everything that's found in, you know, the U.S. mass. The relationships went right out the window. You know, then online bidding came along and just decimated the profitability of these suppliers to U.S. retail. Not only the China guys, but domestic vendors as well. And then there were new costs associated with servicing all these retailers. They all went up. And, you know, importers would just pass this cost on to the factory. You know, if we sold direct to retail, then, you know, we get hit with these costs too. It's always the factory. You know, I've worked for an importer and I've worked for all these Chinese factories. And I got to tell you, the factory, they got it the worst. I mean, they very little that they could pass on to. I mean, in terms of their costs and their problems, there's very little that they could pass on to others. They get hit with everything. And then, you know, a lot, like you said, the rising RMB, the dearth of workers, the overall rising costs of doing business on the East Coast of China. It's just really put a lot of pressure on these guys. You know, we listened to our import customers, you know, bitch about their problems dealing with all the, you know, buyers, American retail. And now it's us. We're selling direct to them and we got the same thing. It's like the Canton system from the 19th century finally turned 180 degrees. My guys in Ningbo, they're very typical. You know, although they're a public company, they face the same challenges as the next OEM. In China, 30 years of emphasis was put on just getting the order, and you had factories just clobbering each other, you know, to get the cheapest price and get the order. Not enough emphasis was put on product development. Nobody developed brands, quality. The feeling was in these OEM factories, it's like, oh, we gave you the cheapest price. You want quality too? You know, no one really figured out how to swim upstream. All these years, just beat each other up, you know, for 30 years. No China brands out there. And now a lot of these guys are just like dead men walking. I mean, their net profits hardly make it attractive or even viable for some. So if you read the fine print of any agreement with a retailer, one factory screw up could sink your business, the penalty, you know, that you have to pay. So the U.S. mass market supply chain, it's just filled with landmines for the China factory, like the guys I work for. Now, I'm not saying that the same holds true for high tech or higher value goods. I'm just talking about my world, you know, which is basically FOB China, $3 and under. You know, these are the guys who are dying. This isn't universally true, but the exporters to the U.S. that you most often hear about who are having a rough go, they're these guys. It's some China OEM guys. They're trying to hire American design, some American management in order to, you know, offer the retailers more value. But if you ask me, it's too little, too late.
Just following up on the question a bit more, is it both a growth explosion of different enterprises offering an undifferentiated product and buyers going directly to the suppliers and squeezing margins? Are those two the main factors?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, the internet just makes it so easy to find these factories. I mean, if you're just a guy who wants to make a brand new kind of pencil sharpener, you know, you could find all these guys on the internet and you just take your sample, you give it to 6-7 factories, and you know, you just play that game. There's no way possible for the factory to win. I mean, they just hold no cards. Only thing they're offering is price. You know how the game is. You know, they give it to 5 or 6 guys. They take the cheapest guy, and then they go to the vendor that they want to work with and say, hey, you know, this guy in Huizhou, he's 87 cents. You're still at $1.20, you know. It, you know, when you play that game, forget it. There's nothing that the factories can do.
I see. So, you know, having the internet and having all of that information at the buyer's fingertips really made it that much more competitive for the suppliers as well. And they use that advantage to sort of drive down the margins.
Yeah, just turn the factory into a commodity, that's all.
Right. Okay, so, you know, with that in mind, how is the manufacturing industry in China, where does it stand right now? You know, what are some of the biggest challenges, and are there still any remaining advantages?
I don't know. You know, I could only speak for that segment that supplies the mass market, you know, in low value goods, you know, like I deal with. I mean, the greatest challenge, just as I said, is just staying alive and surviving in a business environment where the Chinese seller often doesn't have anything to offer beyond the cheapest price. When this isn't always the case. I mean, you can't paint everyone with one brush. In my 25 years in this industry, I've known amazing and passionate factory guys who, you know, have achieved great success and produced quality and consistency. And they're real factory guys, real innovators. You know, some of these guys couldn't even speak a word of English, and they'd still come to the U.S. all the time and attend shows and, you know, soak up as much as they could, you know, to adapt it to whatever it was, you know, they were making. But the lion's share, though, they're just plain old vanilla-flavored OEM factories without an ounce of innovation or enthusiasm for the industry they make for. It's just all about getting customers and getting the order. I mean, I guess this is okay for some, but, you know, but in China, things in the U.S. mass that retail for like under $9.99, for example. You know, this is a huge, huge segment of the mass market, the U.S. mass market. So manufacturers who are selling these, you know, general merchandise products, they have a lot of challenges in front of them if they're, you know, going to stay in the game. There's just too many of them, for one. And the retailers' online bidding systems, you know, also continue to place sustained pressure, you know, on all the high-volume categories of products sold to the U.S. mass market. So I'm not very optimistic about these kinds of manufacturers right now, you know, that I've been involved in all these years.
And with the rising cost of China and global infrastructure being built elsewhere, are you seeing there's been a shift of suppliers looking and sort of diversifying their supply chain outside of China?
Yeah, but that's, you know, how it is. It's just a whole different set of problems. You know, for Chinese, it's easier to go inland to the interior provinces, say Sichuan, places like that. But yeah, that's just a whole other set of problems. It's like, yeah, labor's cheaper, but the transport is an issue, and it's just not the same. And then trying to go to Vietnam or Indonesia, these kind of places, it's just a whole nother can of worms. It's really tough. Most of the guys I know that I've been associated with and worked with, they're China do or die. So they have to find ways to swim upstream and just offer more value added to their customers. Basically, if you're dealing with retailers, this is what they have to offer to retailers. And I'm thinking maybe if that Alibaba model can sort of work itself out for the factories. You know, if the factories can start to profitably sell direct to, you know, smaller operations and deal in, you know, less than container loads, you know, or to sell to individual buyers outside of China as reliably and safely as Amazon does, that might offer, you know, perhaps a life preserver to a lot of these factories. And the current model, selling to big retail is just an OEM factory. It's just death by slow strangulation for the China guy. Something's got to give. I mean, either Walmart starts paying higher prices in China, or many of these China OEMs are just going to perish.
I see. That's a pretty bleak future. Well, with the ray of hope, though, what do you think are the chances of these Chinese companies really coming up with ways to create more value? And maybe we can talk about some of the potential there. and, you know, going direct to consumer as another route?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, the guys I have been with, you know, they haven't been the greatest innovators. They've been okay, but, you know, there are plenty of guys out in China that are just super sharp, and they know how to make new products, and they know how to, you know, read what's going on in the industry. Those are the exception. The main manufacturers, most of the manufacturers, they don't have what it takes. They're just all about the cheapest price, and they're going to have a hard time.
Okay, I see. I guess it's a bit of a survival of the fittest.
Now it is.
Yeah, and what do you think are the characteristics of what would differentiate between someone who can, you know, survive in the next generation?
I'm not going to say it's, you know, people who are more educated, but more educated about their market and more savvy and really understand marketing and what the demands of the market are. They'll survive. They will know how to bring in better management, maybe use talent better and come up with better products and, you know, really fit into that model that's out there if you, you know, if you want to deal with, you know, U.S. retail. But, you know, again, they're out there. They'll survive. I mean, China manufacturing isn't going anywhere. It's just a lot harder to do than it was. Or it's easy to do. It's just a lot harder to make money than it was.
So before we wrap up, can you tell us a bit more about what you've got planned for China History Podcast for this year?
So now I finally have more time to dedicate to developing the podcast. So it really, after 3.5 years, it's really attracted a nice mix of experts and novices. I always say the CHP's core listener is, you know, someone who's interested in China, but probably isn't going to read a China history book. But I have plenty of listeners who are very, very expert and all have, you know, China stories 100 times more interesting than yours truly. As far as, you know, listenability of the China History Podcast goes, I've been told it's Yasu Gongshan. It appeals to all sides. So I'm going to spend much more time in China now. I'm going to work on a bunch of multi-part series, you know, covering the bigger topics like history of Chinese philosophy, tea culture, the warlord era, you know, things like that. And I hope I can wander around China more and just, you know, look for nice stories that have some, you know, interesting history behind them. And I'd like to go to various places around the world and continue to look at the Chinese immigrant experience and do some podcasts on that subject too. You know, Southeast Asia, Australia, Hawaii, Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, you know, all over. Great stories regarding the Chinese experience there, I'm sure. I also just started working on lining up the right sponsor for the CHP. Ideally, I'd like a China company who recognizes the positive message I'm putting out there about China and, you know, who wants to get behind that. And with a quarter century of, you know, being in the trenches, the sponsor has use for my business skill set, you know, that would be even better. So if I could line up an ideal sponsor, maybe I could fully dedicate myself to increasing the frequency of the episodes and add more quality to the content. Right now, I mean, I do it whenever I have time, you know, which is less and less these days. I fund everything. You know, this is totally a labor of love, and I never ask for a penny from anyone. I've been turning down donations for 3 years. I still have hundreds and hundreds of topics I haven't even gotten to yet for the China History Podcast, and more are being added all the time from listener suggestions.
Fantastic. So we'll definitely be looking forward to those new episodes in the new year. All right, any other messages for the audience before we sign off?
Well, you know, Chinese history, it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I recommend that anyone doing business in China consider at least learning about, you know, the last 200 years of Chinese history. You know, 5,000 years, yeah, that's a lot to ask of anyone. But studying the past 200 years of Chinese history, that'll give you some depth and background to better understand things you read about today in China. You know, for example, an understanding about China and Japan's history since 1895, you know, might explain a lot about, you know, relations between those two countries today. So the past couple hundred years are the most relevant, and that's where people should, you know, if they want to know a little bit about China, that's a good place to start. So I want to throw that out there. And for anyone looking to learn, the China History Podcast is a good place to start and learn about that time period, and I give it my highest possible recommendations.
And I will second that recommendation as well. We'll link up to the China History Podcast in the show notes. And I will also link to a few of my favorite episodes about the prominent Chinese business people who sort of shaped, you know, business in China. And with that, thank you very much, Laszlo Montgomery, for coming on the show.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, JP. Quite a pleasure.
Hope you've enjoyed this episode of China Business Cast. Head over to ChinaBusinessCast.com and enter your email to get on the list. I'll announce guests before I interview them, and you'll get a chance to submit your question for the show. Till next time, thank you for listening.